and for his response to not only be, I'm proud of you in this moment for this great work that you've created and the fact that you're going to be okay, but to make sure she knows that it's not new, that he's mm-hmm. always been proud of his daughters. Absolutely. Really got me.
It's so good. Well, hey, Lillian, what's happening?
Not much, Piper. What's happening with you?
Not much. I'm kind of sleepy, but I'm excited to talk about the lives of the Brontes as told by a very beloved, I would call this a mini series. It's two episodes.
Yeah, it's two episodes, and they call them episodes. It's weird. I think it probably aired on TV as like a special, mm-hmm. But it could have been a movie.
Yeah, it could have. It was literally 2 hours. And it had very much film quality, but it is a masterpiece on PBS. So,
yeah. I think original BBC, and then a lot of times they collaborate with Masterpiece and it comes over here.
Well, I'm an American, Lillian, and I love PBS. So it's a Masterpiece PBS.
That's a fun fact that I don't know that our listeners fully know about you, that they should, is what a PBS kid you were, in the best way.
Well, okay. Yeah. So I didn't have cable growing up. So I grew up, like, my entertainment was TPT Kids on PBS.
Yeah.
And Lillian and I almost became PBS kids. I roped her into an audition and we made it to the second round, but no further.
Yeah.
They couldn't handle us.
we were too hot for TV. They know that. It's why our podcast is thriving so much.
Yeah.
Definitely because we've always been this talented.
Exactly. And hot as in we're really cool, not attractive children. Because
we were children. Like sexy middle schoolers.
I definitely thought I was. I was not. I was like, why aren't boys talking to me? Because I'm a weird little toad.
You shouldn't be. You shouldn't be a hot middle schooler. That's not a thing.
No, totally. It's a thing. I look back now and I'm like, eesh, yikes. But little me, I was like, I'm a sexy lady. It's like, just stop doing this. Go watch Arthur.
I, on the other hand, was under the impression that I was a middle-aged mother of 5 children, and I twasn't. That's the energy I brought to social occasions, though.
You know who had to kind of act that way just by necessity? Charlotte Bronte.
Yes, thank
like
you
the
for
eldest woman
us back.
In her house. So we watched To Walk Invisible by Sally Wainwright, the creator of our beloved Gentleman Jack. And it was lovely. And there's so much stuff about this that I'm like, hey, that's a location from Gentleman Jack. That actor's in Gentleman Jack. That person's in Gentleman Jack. And I'm like, they keep mentioning Halifax. Ah, it's the show.
Well, and it's so fun because there's allusions to the idea that like they could have met Anne Lister. Is that her name?
Mm-hmm.
There's reason to believe that there's a small chance that Emily did. Like, this is how much people want these women to have met each other. And I think it's because we all know they would have been friends in the best way.
Yeah.
But
they were all brilliant women ahead of their time.
Yeah. Spoilers for my feelings about it. I loved watching this. It was so much fun. My notes are light because I was so engaged in watching the show.
Awesome.
I was all cozy. My house is chilly this time of year, and so I was all cozy up in a blanket just watching the show, being like, oh, that's right, I have to talk to people about my opinions, not just enjoy.
I agree. I thought it was beautifully filmed. It was well acted. I thought it did a really good job of kind of balancing just like details that felt very well researched and realistic about the characters, while also giving us moments of kind of imagination and creativity to kind of like insert in like how these kind of stories and ideas kind of came to be without being quite so over the top as some of the other versions we've seen.
Yeah. And I think this is definitely, our listeners were right. This has been recommended to us almost more than anything else, partly because it's been so long since people recommended it that we started watching it. Mm-hmm. But the first person to recommend it who gets credit for it is Julie. I did double check that in my notes. So thank you guys so much for telling us to watch this. I think it's a great fit for the show. And like a lot of the, it looks like a lot of it was filmed in the actual Parsonage. Obviously the part at the end was in the, spoilers for the very end of this program, was in the Parsonage Museum. Mm-hmm. They ended it exactly how I said I wanted that other documentary to end, where it's not about their deaths. It's not about the sad very end of their lives. It's about the impact that they've had on the world.
Yeah, their legacy. Yeah. Although, so it was so interesting because I kept thinking to myself, I'm like, yeah, I think they're filming in the actual house. But then when they show the clip at the end of the actual house, it has a lot more kind of like modern things, like a radiator in the hallway and these like fancier lights and all kinds of other stuff. So I'm like, okay, is this just a really good recreation of their home, the set that they're filming in?
It seems to be, parts of it are. And I think that's, it's interesting. I'd love to watch a behind the scenes thing on this to see some of that stuff, but who's to say? But we decided not to do a recap of this because we'd be recapping the Brontes' lives and that feels weird. So we're going to just, first of all, I am really glad that we, when we watched this and our experience of researching the Brontes, like, I like that we have seen that terrible documentary. I like that we already watched Emily to know like how inaccurate that was and to learn about myself, how annoyed I was going to be by that. And then I also like that we'd already watched Wuthering Heights, because I think there was a lot of, you can sort of see the inspiration of these different series that these women have created, or these different books that these women created in their lives. Obviously that's intentional because these stories are, this is playing off of our nostalgia for these stories as much as these women. But yeah, they start, a note, a detail that I wouldn't have noticed if we hadn't watched that terrible documentary, was they start with the toy soldiers.
Yeah, exactly. And they had a very interesting kind of visual representation. I mean, we get this kind of like slow-mo shot of the children running through this house, a house that is much grander than like their actual home that they're living in. And they have these like flaming halos above their heads. And when they open up this like box with the soldiers, it's like actual people, like little tiny men. And there's like a very quick shot of one of the soldiers' faces, and I didn't go back and actually look, but I'm like, wait, I think that's a well-known actor. Like, it seemed
so
like
all the soldiers had IMDb pages, so I do think they were all pretty famous.
Okay, yeah, because the one guy's face, I saw it for a split second, and I'm like, I know that guy from something, but I can't think of what it is.
So I kept waiting for them to come back.
Yeah, more soldiers.
I was like, tell me more about these soldiers. But I think it was such a great, they did such a good job with that, and there's a couple other moments. I really love when they frame sort of that inner child and really show that, because like I think a fact about life that I'm learning more and more every year I get older is that that inner child, like, that doesn't go away. We're all just big kids playing dress up. And I think that showing that moment of the representation of that imagination as those flaming halos.
Yeah.
I think that that's so fun, and how visible that is as a child and how much joy there was for those children, I think is a really important framing device when you're telling the story of the Brontes.
Yeah.
Because their lives have so many bleak facts that forgetting that imagination and joy is the part that their art kind of stems from.
Right.
Is this collective like joyful energy of where were they the most, I think it's Anne says that it's where she was the most alive.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something that I think there's an interesting sort of transition section in the early part of the first episode where it's Anne and it's Emily kind of discussing whether or not they should start writing more realistic stories or coming up with more realistic stories instead of just this kind of like fantasy world that they've been creating in. And I think maybe it's partially first inspired by Charlotte's kind of gloominess. She's like grow up essentially, which I was thinking about how when we saw in the Emily version, you were very like upset that they had Charlotte being like, writing is for babies. And the rest of them are like, no, we still like it. And you're like, that's not true. But they did it in this too. And it's just no. Like, it's not that she's like writing's for babies forever. She's just sad right now that her love was not reciprocated. And so she's like, you guys should grow up because I'm really sad and you should be sad too.
Well, and I think that that's the difference in the way that they framed it is like, mm-hmm. I think that, Charlotte in this has a similar energy to the character that Charlotte has in Emily. But the difference is the way it's framed here is this is a complicated woman who has really complicated feelings and is trying to do her best and is in a position that is difficult.
Yeah.
And in the Emily movie, it was, this lady's got a stick up her butt and Emily's the fun one.
Yeah. It was definitely way more kind of like, oh, let's pit them against one another kind of a thing.
Well, and there's a nuance to that feeling of she is being that the idea of telling someone to grow up. I think both you and I have enjoyed things as an adult that people think of as something you should let go in childhood. Mm-hmm. And I think like that imagination, like we think of imagination as something that kids get to enjoy and that you should let go of when you're an adult. Mm-hmm. And I think that we see Charlotte's frustration with that idea when she's talking to Emily later and she says her a little rant that feels quite Jane Eyre-esque of looking out a window and saying, women's inner lives is just as rich as men's inner lives. And I think that is the frustration that she's having is, and I think it's one of the reasons why women are often the gatekeepers of gender norms mm-hmm. is if I'm shoved into this box, you better be shoved into this box. If yeah. I'm going to be unhappy living this life because it's what I have to do because of society, mm-hmm. then you also have to do it because if it's not the right thing to do, then why am I doing it?
I agree. And I think we see Charlotte do this several times in the first half of this series, because I actually had a note of kind of a similar interaction that she has with Branwell, in mm-hmm. which he is like having this kind of, it's one of his first kind of like breakdown moments, but she doesn't really like go to comfort him or reassure him in any way. She kind of gives him like a little bit of like a pick yourself up by the bootstraps kind of a lecture.
Yeah.
And my note about that was, it's like, that's not so much, I think it's partially Charlotte talking to her brother, but it's also her like saying this to herself kind of a thing where she's like, and I actually, it's interesting to think about the parallels between their kind of life journeys. Because he actually had an affair with a married person, Charlotte wanted to, but didn't. Like she just like left. And so I think it's like interesting of her being like, it's like, no, you don't give in to that stupid temptation. You keep going. And yeah, you have heartbreak because this married person can't be with you, even though you love them. But we have to be better than that. And so it's a lot of her kind of, I think, talking to herself subconsciously yeah. and framing it through talking to her siblings.
And I also think it's something that I think about a lot, and I was thinking about a lot watching this, is, and especially as you bring up the parallel between the situation that Charlotte is in and the situation that Branwell is in, is we have a lot more leniency. And I'm not saying that the end of their stories was not equally, if so, Branwell's story is undeniably tragic, like mm-hmm. there's no way to, so I'm saying this is a commentary on society, and it's something that I've seen paralleled in my own life and in my own family history and experiences, because Piper, as you know, many of my family members alcoholics, anyway, not quite this bad in my closer family members. We are not going to go into that.
No, we're not.
but I think that there's a difference. There's a difference that I see in the way that women respond to situations like this. And it's not consistent for all women and everybody is an individual. But I think that some of the things that I see in the differences in how Charlotte is responding and how Branwell is responding is partly probably their personalities, but it's also probably partly the expectation of society. Society mm-hmm. expects young men to have affairs, mm-hmm. like probably not sleep with a married woman, but you're supposed to have sex. Where a a young woman is not supposed to do that. So the part of the reason why those two people reacted differently to those situations was the expectation. And then their reaction to the heartbreak is similarly different, partly because of their personalities and partly because of the expectations of them based on their gender. It is, while Branwell took it further than was socially acceptable, it is socially acceptable for men, if they're heartbroken, to go get drunk in the bar and pass out in the yard and do a couple of things that are embarrassing for the family. And then you're going to pick yourself up and brush yourself up and keep moving forward. That's how their father responded. That's what his expectation was of Branwell until he was truly at a point where he was unable to come back from that. Mm-hmm. Everyone kept saying he's going to come back from that. The father, to the very end, was sure that this was going to be the bottom, and this time he was going to turn it around, and this time he was going to come back better than ever.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying those expectations didn't hurt both of those people, mm-hmm. but Emily couldn't do that. Or no, sorry, Charlotte couldn't do that. Yeah. Charlotte couldn't go to the bar and get drunk. Charlotte couldn't fall apart. There was no option for her to do anything, but she could be sad, mm-hmm. but she had to keep moving forward.
Yeah. And I think all of the siblings attempted to channel their kind of, you know, frustration or heartbreak mm-hmm. or whatever it may be into their writing. It's just that, you know, three of them succeeded and one didn't.
Well, and I think it's interesting that part of the reason why they kept their identities a secret, even after it was successful, mm-hmm. was to protect Branwell.
Yeah.
That was really tragic and heartbreaking.
It was really interesting to see how the family as a whole reacted to his mm-hmm. spiral. Like how many times they would, like, you've talked about the father, like, pretty much until the end being like, no, ideally this time with mm-hmm. prayer and like some solitude and healing, he's going to be just fine and it'll be great, until like that very moment when the people come to collect the debt and they threaten to take him off to the debtor's prison. And for a split second, he's like, yeah, take him. And I'm like, honestly, though, that might be for the best. Like, stop
this. He would for sure 100% die in a debtor's prison in 1847.
But he also is going to die at the house.
He died at home, and it didn't cost them, and it would have saved them 14 pounds, which was a lot of money at the time.
Then the dad brings him back, and he's like, no. All right. I scared you straight for 30 seconds, and then I pulled back the threat, so you can die at the house instead.
I do have more commentary on that moment, but I want to loop back to the beginning and chat a bit more about some of the things that happened early on.
Well, for sure. I also just want to say, though, there's other moments when, like, the journeys that each of the sisters kind of go on with dealing mm-hmm. with Bran. I think Charlotte is the first to write him off and be like, no, I'm kind of done with you. And we see that scene when they're going to church, I assume probably on Easter, because it seems like a really big deal that day with all the bells ringing and everything. Mm-hmm. And he's all stumbling in the street, and the three sisters walk by, and Charlotte just doesn't look at him. I think the others look concerned, and then it's Emily who goes back and actually helps him out, but Charlotte keeps on walking.
Again, I think that's a really interesting moment that I want to talk about more, but I want to talk about some of the things that happened earlier before I dive too much into my thoughts.
Well, then we can do some rewind.
Sorry.
Yeah. Sorry. We were just on this topic, so I figured we'd go into it, but yeah.
No,
what
I
do
know.
You want to talk about in the beginning?
I think the first thing is going to be a bit lighter than some of the things that we're talking about in this particular moment. But this was a rabbit hole that I spent quite a bit of time in. The woman that Branwell had an affair with, her name is Mrs. Robinson.
Nice.
Do you know that, Ref? Like, that's...
Yeah, Mrs. Robinson, I think you're trying to seduce me.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I tried so hard to find out... Because it's an older woman who mm-hmm. seduces a younger man. Mm-hmm. And it's so wild to me that, like, that couldn't be. It has to be inspired by this. So I found I'm not the only person who thinks that.
Uh-huh.
A lot of other people also think that, especially given the time that The Graduate was written and the how well-known some of these stories were at the time. Mm-hmm. But... officially, the author has not confirmed that the character of Mrs. Robinson is named after the Mrs. Robinson who seduced Branwell Bronte.
That would be, I feel like it feels more likely to me that it's just a coincidence that's a similar name. It just feels way too niche to be like, oh, I care about the Bronte history so much that I know the woman who seduced the brother and I'm going to make that into my seduction story.
There's too many parallels. I went too far down this rabbit hole.
This is Lillian's tin hat theory.
Exactly. If I'm going to believe in a conspiracy theory, this is the one. There's wow. No way. Like, there's so many other names in the world. Why would it be this name?
Lillian, did you also look into the song "Here's to You, Mrs. Robinson"?
That is inspired by The Graduate, so okay. It would all be connected together.
I see.
And yes, I did.
Good. 3 degrees of seduction.
But that it's just. Can you just for a second live with me in my tin hat moment?
Yes.
Because
it's crowded in.
That's a song that we all know. That's a mm-hmm. line that we all know from a story that we all know that potentially could be based off of some random lady mm-hmm. in 1846 had an affair with some random pimple-faced boy who worked in her house. And she's remembered. We're talking about her in 2023, and her name is famous.
Yeah. I mean, if it's her, then her ghost is having a little party. She's like, dude, I am so remembered.
Oh, God. That was really funny to me anyway. I fully believe this. I like 100% am convinced. I would love to have a full PowerPoint presentation about why I'm right, but that's not what this podcast is for.
I love it. Although I think instead of a PowerPoint presentation, it would be the screenshot of Charlie Day from Always Sunny with his board looking for Pepe Sylvia. Except for you, it's Mrs. Robinson.
And it's just one side it's The Graduate and the other side it's this Victorian woman and I have a single red thread.
Just one red thread.
And then above it it says Mrs. Robinson and then it's me going, like, yeah, obviously.
Duh. Yeah. Easy.
Oh.
Well, if that lady did take inspiration from this person, then she is in the club with the Brontes who take their inspiration from other things in their lives, like yeah. the fact that Emily's idea for Wuthering Heights is inspired by this like gossip story or legend of this like kind of area, which my note for that one just simply says in all caps, bang, Heathcliff. Because, like, when she's talking and then it, like, cuts to that moment where there's a lightning bolt and then so an edgy good. Man standing up on a cliff. And I was like, and then he was born.
And what I loved about this was they did just enough about that kind of thing to make it feel like just a little bit of that magical realism. Mm-hmm. But not so much that it distracted from the story. Like,
yes,
it's like the crowns on the children. And I also like the idea that, like, when Charlotte has a similar inspiration moment, there's a moment later that feels very parallel to that, where Charlotte's looking out the window and she writes the line, there was no possibility of a walk that day. Mm-hmm. And I squealed like a small child seeing a celebrity.
Yeah, like you do.
But I think that speaks to the difference in the personality of these women, where mm-hmm. Charlotte's ever so slightly more grounded in what's happening here and now, at where... For Emily, it's like that halo of fire did not go away for her.
Yeah.
And she sees this whole moment of she sees an entire man with a storm behind him standing out on the moors. Mm-hmm. And I love when little moments of characterization can come through in that kind of difference.
Yeah. Let's talk about Emily for a bit because
yes.
my main note that I was like kind of pondering about while watching the second episode is that unlike the movie Emily, which I do think is fun, but it definitely yeah. is way more on the dramatic side, this portrayal of Emily Bronte, this is a woman who I look at her and I'm like, you definitely seem weird enough and passionate enough and angry enough to have written Wuthering Heights. Uh-huh. And the movie didn't have to make up a passionate romance or all kinds of other stuff. It was just the way that she exists in her world. I totally believe that story came out of that person.
Absolutely. And I think there were so many moments of, because I think we can kind of come back to some of the things I was thinking of with the other moments that you referenced, which is, Emily very early on in the story, when she's at the house more, she, and you can see that with her in a lot of the other ways that she engages. She's always in the kitchen. She's always doing laundry. She helps out in the house more. She's spent more time at home than her sisters. Both of her sisters have gone off and done other things. Emily went to Belgium as well, but she came back significantly earlier because of their sick aunt, I believe. And so she's just more in the house. So she spent more time with Branwell than Anne and Charlotte have, particularly in the most recent period of time. And she said, she's the one who says at the beginning that she has this empathy and this understanding for the torment that Branwell's going through. Mm-hmm. She says right away, I was so angry with him, and I started thinking about the expectations that we all put on him, father especially, and I realized that we have been expecting him to be a person that he's not, and I'm letting go of that person because that's the person I was mad at, and I'm accepting him for the person that he is. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that come to life in so many moments. Like there's a moment in particular where she's sitting outside the house waiting for Branwell to come home. And you can tell that she's angry that he's been out, but she's also worried. And there's so much feeling for both of those characters in that moment, because I expected some kind of confrontation. And instead it's just these siblings who love each other. And you can see Emily really living that statement of she's accepting her brother for who he is right now. And she still cares about him and she still loves him and she's still grieving the person that he could have been.
Yeah. That's the scene when they are sitting on the fence howling at the dogs. Yeah.
Yeah. They howl with the dogs, which feels very Wuthering Heights to me too.
Oh yes. 100%. Yeah. And yep. It's with what I mentioned too. Emily is the one who goes and picks him up. I think that closeness is there. It's something that is also explored in the Emily movie of they're kind of these two. I mean, I feel like they're all sort of outcasts, but she and Bran are the most of the, they're the weirdest of the weird ones.
Well, and I liked that they highlighted that relationship without diminishing the relationship she has with her sisters.
Yeah,
like exactly. I think that was what I found frustrating in the Emily movie, where I really like the way they did it here, where like the woman who wrote Wuthering Heights was really angry and had sympathy for people who made shitty decisions.
Yeah.
And that is incredibly painful to have empathy for people who you love, who are hurting themselves and hurting you.
Yeah.
And to continue to love them without letting them have negative impact on your life is a really hard balance to take.
Yeah.
And I think they captured that incredibly well in the relationships that these women have with their brother and in the relationships that they have with their father because of his enabling of their brother. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is so powerful about both of those moments that you mentioned, the walking down the street and Branwell's up against the wall and the moment where the father is going to send him off. And it's because those moments happen in that order, that he's up against the wall and they have decided, and it feels like they've all written him off, right? That Emily's exhibiting that empathy and she can't watch him like that anymore. Anne is like too hurt and too upset with the place that he's in and blames herself too much. And Charlotte is just over it and leaving. And then the contrast of that moment to all three of them saying no when their father's going to send her brother off to the debtor's prison. Mm-hmm. And she goes, and Emily goes and gets that blanket and they bring him back inside because they still love him and they're not going to let him go die in a cold, dark room.
Yeah. It's interesting. I was thinking too that even though Bran wasn't like successful with his writing or like pretty much anything that he attempted, at least this movie implies that his impact is how his kind of sorrow influenced all of their writing.
Yeah.
Like we get that moment where Anne asks Emily, do you think it's wrong to draw from real life? And she's like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I'm thinking about a story about a woman who has to take her child and leave because the man that she married because of his alcoholism is like not who he used to be. And it's so interesting to think about, like, oh, the suffering that they witnessed with their brother, that influenced the conflict in the story that Anne wrote. You could see its presence in Heathcliff. You can see its presence in Rochester. And mm-hmm. so that's kind of, I think, Bran's impact.
Yeah. And I think it's being able to see the complexity in that kind of person, mm-hmm. being able to love that kind of person, even if it's not, and I don't want to make anybody think that I'm making any sort of incestual connotations here, because I'm definitely, definitely not. But loving somebody in a family way can be just as painful, if not more painful, than loving someone in a romantic way. Like these women had to figure out how to support their family and themselves and create stability with a sick elderly father and a brother who was actively abusing their father. And to be able to reflect that with, I think it's the thing that Anne says when they tell their father about the writing, and she says, he goes, what about it was, what was it, lewd?
Salacious or something?
Salacious or something. Yeah. And she goes, it wasn't. It was honest and it was real and it was a reflection of life, and people are afraid of that. And I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's true of all these books. And the thing that is, it's the thing we talked about a few weeks ago when we were talking about the BBC and the Brontes, which is the honest reflection of life. Mm-hmm. Like the things, describing things that they understand because it's so close to home, is what has made these timeless. Mm-hmm. And I do wonder, this is somewhat off topic, but it sort of relates to the moment they choose to start publishing. And I think particularly the first episode really focuses on that journey of how do they decide to actually put themselves out there, and deciding to specifically, like, the name of the movie, To Walk Invisible, mm-hmm. they decide they're going to hide their identities. And I'm curious because I've always thought of that as like, oh, these women like couldn't get recognition for their writing, so they had to hide behind the idea of being a man, which is 100% true. But a thing that can also be true is I wonder if when they were writing, they were under the impression that no one would know who they were, if that made them braver in their honesty.
I think for Emily especially, it's implied mm-hmm. that was a big thing for her, because she was, it seemed through this actor and writer's portrayal that Emily was like really afraid of criticism or ridicule for her writing because she puts so much of her honest self into it. And that's just, I think, something that was like really emphasized, because they really had to like convince Emily to be the mm-hmm. one to help share, because her poetry was like so good and so raw and all this other stuff. And it's the same thing too, when they decide they have to go to London to like confront the publishers to be like, hey, you made this mistake. We need to like own up for this. Emily is the one who's like, no, I only did this because you promised no one would know that it was us. Like, I think she's afraid of somebody like saying, oh, wait, Emily Bronte, that weird girl, she wrote this. Actually, it's garbage, like kind of a thing.
Well, and it ties really well into the line that Emily says towards the end of the first episode, which is when a man writes something, it's the writing that is judged. When a woman writes something, it's her that's judged.
Yeah.
And my thoughts on that I wrote in my notes was like a little dash, and then in all caps, the word fuck. Because mm-hmm. I think that is not only true in art that's created, whether that's writing or other things, but frankly, it's true in life. Mm-hmm. When a man does something, his actions are judged. A woman is always the person that's judged, regardless of the actions that she's doing around her. Like, we judge the person. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that in the way that these women are judged versus their brother.
Yeah.
With their brother, his drinking is the problem. He is mm-hmm. not the problem.
Yeah. But he can always pick himself up again.
But these women are fundamentally weird.
Which is why, if I may do a quick positive spin and somewhat reference to endings, it's why my happiest moments in watching this are when they come out to their father and he's supportive. And then also when they like talk to the publisher and how real or not that was, that scene, I needed that care. Of the two publisher men being like, oh my God, you're Courier Bell, Mrs. Bronte or Miss Bronte. It's such an honor to meet you. Can we take you out to the opera? And like, there's just so excited and encouraging. And I'm like, oh, this is precious. Yes, it's so nice. They don't care that they're women. It's lovely.
We and have to my talk heart. About that moment with the dad. It's so important to me.
They all have cake. They're celebrating with cake, which seems like a very special treat that they brought out the cakes to talk about his daughter's success.
I love every part of that scene. I love that it's Emily who goes in and he's just so defeated, and she can see how much just his life is weighing on him. And she realizes, again, that that hyper empathy, which a lot of times deeply introverted people who are really quiet, which tangent on my own tangent. The moments, the way they reflect Emily's shyness and introversion is incredibly well done. My favorite moment, there's anytime she's in a room with someone, she's dead silent, unless it's her family, and then she's super loud. Literally, there's a moment where both her and Anne are going to open the door, and Anne like puts her hand on the knob and then like looks at Emily, and Emily like takes a step back to the wall because Anne's like, I'm gonna open the door now and you don't want to see people.
Well, their housekeeper like makes a reference to that too. Like, Emily is screaming about something and she's like, the people in town think you're quiet as a mouse. If only they could hear you now.
And like, that's so good. And then the so she goes in, she sees her father, this incredible empathy that she has as someone who is clearly an observer of the human condition. She realizes that he needs something in this moment to buoy him. And she goes back into the room where her sisters are working on writing all these things. And they're also upset because they heard this fight with Branwell and all this stuff. And she's like, Charlotte, you have to tell him about Jane Eyre. And she's like, what? Why? What? No. And she has that line about like, I know this is like a different, this is different from what I've said before, but sometimes my second thoughts are better than my first. Love that. I want that tattooed on my ass. Anyway.
Oh my gosh. But no, I agree. It's a great moment. And yeah, he's very receptive. And I think it's so interesting. There's so many little details, like right away when he's like, oh, well, I don't have time to read your book. Also, your handwriting is so small. And I loved that was something I clocked right away at the very beginning when we see Anne writing with the tiny little script. And we know from the documentary that they did that because they didn't want their father to read their writing and get upset. And so it's like the layers of like that attention to detail is really cute. And then also the adult like realization that your father can read this work and like not chastise you.
Yeah.
Because they still think of, I think, themselves as like the kids and he's the dad, which they are technically, but they're also all adults in this room. And so for him to be like, oh yeah, like even though he's like a clergyman, he's still like, he's like, oh no, like this is cool. Like, is it like really salacious? Like, would I be uncomfortable as your father reading this? And they're like, no. Just people are silly about stuff. It's fine. Yeah. He's like, okay, rad, cool.
Well, and I even love how they framed that moment. It's so such a good sibling dynamic. They do such a great job of capturing the sibling dynamic between these sisters, because like Emily comes in and basically makes, she goes, you're going to go first because Jane Eyre was so popular. And then we're obviously also going to tell him. And she like picks, she hands each of them their books, and she goes in with the three volumes of Jane Eyre, and she knocks on the door and he's like busy and all this stuff. But we see all of that from the perspective of the other sisters and they keep looking at each other like, oh my God, like I have to do this for real. And they're so nervous. And then I truly cried like a lot, like during that scene when she's like telling him. And specifically the line that really got me was when he realizes what this is. And there's a moment where he could react poorly to that. Like he could be like, this is embarrassing. You can't tell anyone else, like all this other stuff. But instead his reaction is, I'm proud of you. I've always been proud of you.
Yeah.
Because they wanted him to be proud. They wanted him to have children he could be proud of and to know he didn't need to worry about his daughters. Mm-hmm. And for his response to not only be, I'm proud of you in this moment for this great work that you've created and the fact that you're going to be okay, but to make sure she knows that it's not new, that he's mm-hmm. always been proud of his daughters. Absolutely. Really got me.
It's so good. It's also something too that I think they did really well where there's never really, apart from like clarifying the information, there's never like a denial of the truth they've just shared with him. Yeah. Like there isn't a moment where he's like, no, you're not this person. Yeah. Like, I don't believe you. Like, cause he knows like with that statement of like, I've always like believed in you kind of a thing. He's like, well, of course you guys are clever enough to do this. So now that I think of it, yeah, that makes sense. That's you guys.
Yeah.
And I think there's a really cool scene that they do when Charlotte and Anne go to confront the publishers as well, where this is a man who doesn't have all these years of experience of knowing how clever Charlotte is, but the way that they frame it to kind of get this point across to him is it goes mm-hmm. from kind of being filmed where you can kind of see like almost over his shoulder and then she's talking to him to then suddenly it cuts to like a camera straight on her face and she gives this very intense kind of line delivery of being like, and why would like blah blah blah, I can't remember exactly what she says, but it's something to essentially be like, look, what I'm telling you is I am this person and what cause do you have to doubt me? And like mm-hmm. that level of like, it's like he sees Jane in her instantly mm-hmm. and he's like, oh, I get it. Wow, this is real. Okay, hi. I'm so sorry. Hello, kind of a thing.
And that's really truly cool. It's truly one of the things that I wrote down because we had heard the anecdote of her, how her publishers found out who she was and all that stuff. But I truly will never stop finding it funny that truly only a man would see a small, plain woman and be like, wait, hold on. You wrote Jane Eyre? That's crazy. I'm like, no, it's not. She's Jane Eyre.
It's her.
That is who she is.
Yeah.
Obviously, she wrote Jane Eyre. I also think it's very adorable that Anne believes that those men didn't tell their wives. Like, when they went to the opera with their wives and children, she was like, they didn't tell anyone. Who do these people think we are? And I'm like, I don't know that you know. I'm pretty sure the main reason to get married is now I'm legally entitled to all your secrets. I assume everything I tell you, your husband also knows.
Yeah. Unless you make me like do a blood oath and then.
Yeah.
Then
unless I explicitly say, secret. Don't tell Sam this. Yes. But I'm pranking him.
Right.
Which is the rules of pranks prevent you from telling him.
Of course. Yes. That's also a solemn oath.
Yes.
But yeah, no, I loved it. I also have just a silly little note that when the two sisters are on their way to London, they're all bundled up in their train car. And I just wrote two piggies in a blanket because they just look so snuggly. Snuggly things are important to talk about too, you know, guys, not just emotional levels of complex family relationships.
Yes.
You got to talk about the piggies and the blankies.
Yes. And I do like just in general, I have a couple other specific little things that I want to talk about too, but I do like, if you like this podcast and you like the Brontes, or even if you just like this podcast, you would love this show. It's so good. It's 2 hours of just like, I just was having a little joy. Mm-hmm. It was so great. And they do a really good job of balancing. They do the exact opposite of what that documentary did, mm-hmm. where the documentary and frankly what Emily 2022 did, which is the documentary told this very sad story about these very sad ladies who made these very sad books. Mm-hmm. And then Emily was like, these women's lives had to have been dramatic for this to have been something they were capable of writing. And I think this story went, these women were incredible. Mm-hmm. Their lives, like all lives, were full of ups and downs. There was tragedies and there were joys and there were things that were good about their lives and there were things that were bad about their lives. It was the women living those lives that were incredible and that were able to capture that mm-hmm. through this art. It's something that I often get really frustrated by, the idea that suffering is what is required to inspire great art. Mm-hmm. And, I feel like it's this is answering the question in the way that I usually answer it, which is life inspires great art. Mm-hmm. Living a life is what does that. And no life is without suffering.
Yeah.
And exactly. That is always going to be reflected in art. But so is joy. Mm-hmm. And if you read Jane Eyre, both of those things are in there. One is easier to miss because it's not quite as jarring. Mm-hmm. But both of those things are in there.
Exactly. You can't have a fully sad story or a fully happy story. Mm-hmm. You need the balance of the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one thing that they got absolutely correct, and all historians would agree, is that without a doubt, Emily is the one who would know where the gun is kept.
That is an actual real fact, by the way. That is, like, truly, we had a listener reach out to us and tell us that that is an actual true fact, that when her father would go out of town, he would make sure Emily knew where the gun was, not Branwell.
Well, yeah, Branwell would accidentally shoot his own foot off.
Even before.
That's amazing. So, freaking loved that one. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of my notes are just, like, talking about where I know the actors from or who they remind me of. So
tell me about those.
I will.
I want to start with mine because I have one note on one of the actors, which I'm sure you also have.
Yes.
So Jonathan Pryce played the father. Mm-hmm. He is 76 years old now. He was 69 when this was filmed. And he reminded me, his energy in this reminded me so much of another dad from another historical, like, period thing. It was driving me absolutely nuts.
He's Governor Swan.
It was Governor Swan. Yes. That's what it was.
He was in Pirates
of the Caribbean as Governor Swan fully 13 years before that. So he was 53 at the time he played Governor Swan, which he seemed so much older than that in that movie.
Well, because he had a big powder wig on.
And he also just had the anxiety of a much older man. But he also was in Game of Thrones and a ton of other things.
Yes.
But he's the one I had that was driving me nuts.
Yeah, no. The fact that Dad is Governor Swan is my very first note that I took on this. But also, this is not actually who this person is, but the woman who played Charlotte reminded me very much of Maisie Williams. Just with her kind of, like, stout, round face. It's very Maisie. And Maisie is also in Game of Thrones. She plays the youngest Stark daughter.
Another person this actress reminded me of that she's also not is I think of her as Moaning Myrtle from Harry Potter.
Oh.
That she also played the shrew in Taming of the Shrew in that version you wanted us to watch.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I can kind of see that in her. The tininess. They're both very, very small.
And the face shape.
Yeah. So I got that one there. They're so the two actors that stood out to me as also being in Gentleman Jack, one is the coachman who comes to warn Branwell not to come and pursue the widow. Because he was Ann Lister's solicitor in the show. And then also the guy who delivers the letter letting Courier Bell know that they're being published. He is also in Gentleman Jack. He plays like a housekeeper. He's like one of the house staff who tries to marry the French lady when she's pregnant.
That's what it was. That was driving me nuts. Because he would come on screen and I'd be like, I should IMDb him. And then something interesting would happen and I wouldn't.
He also, and I said this when we did Gentleman Jack, he's also in Downton Abbey. He is the footman that Daisy is persuaded into marrying before he dies. Sorry, spoilers.
I look at people and we should really put spoiler warnings for Downton Abbey at the beginning of this.
It's like
season six or something.
We might talk about Downton Abbey deaths, marriages, scandals, so listen, just be warned.
Any episode of the podcast, we could spoil Downton Abbey for you. So just be emotionally prepared for that.
I'm sure I've shared this on the podcast before, but I think my most embarrassing embarrassing, like, accidental spoiler that I ever gave someone is when Sam and I were on a double date with our friends, Lizzie and Kevin, and we were in a canoe out on a boat. And Lizzie said that she had started watching Downton Abbey, and my dumb brain immediately just went, oh, have you gotten to the part yet where Sybil dies? And she's like, I'm so mad that I'm stuck in a canoe with you right now. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. I don't know why I said that.
You told me about this at the time, and I maintain to this day, she should have pushed you off the boat.
Yeah,
she should have just, like, legally entitled to push you out of the canoe.
So we all could have gone down together.
That is like an unforgivable spoiler, and I'm so glad it still haunts you.
Oh, I feel so bad about it. We saw them over the summer, and I'm like, I think about this, like, every day. And she's like, it's okay, I've forgiven you. And I'm like, oh, thank God.
I wouldn't have been over it yet, just so you know.
I thought this was so cool. So they clearly filmed in, like, the same place as well, because what they refer to as, like, some kind of, like, big inn or hotel that's, like, in or near Halifax, where a lot of this is happening, is in Gentleman Jack. It's Anne Lister's family estate. And I could tell, I think they were trying to hide it because it has a very distinct, like, black and white striping around the outside of it. But there's one shot when the carriage pulls up, and I've now seen Gentleman Jack twice. So I'm like, that courtyard looks strangely familiar to me. And I caught just for a brief instant the black and white striping. I'm like, ha ha, yes, it's a mansion. They're pretending it's a manor house or an inn.
That's crazy.
It was so fun to see
that. The idea that people shooting TV shows in the UK would reuse sets is so rude.
I know. They only have so many historical landmarks they can film in.
I will say, completely side note, and then I have a couple little facts that are related to this show, but when we were watching All That Heaven Allows, is that what it's called? One of my favorite moments, we were watching that with our friends at Piper's house, was the opening, like, establishing shot where it comes down, and I'm like, hey, that's the town square from Gilmore Girls. And everybody around us went, eh!
Isn't it exciting really when you recognize places?
It is. It's so much fun. And if you don't find that fun, then get out of our podcast.
Yeah, leave.
Just either kidding. Find Come this fun or leave. No, it's okay.
We it's love okay. you. It's Sorry. A joke.
That was we're really just, harsh of us.
We're just teasing to send you off to debtor's prison, but then we're going to chicken out on our dare and put a blanket around you and bring you back inside. So yeah, you can die though. In your bloody little bed in our house.
Of course. That you share with your dad now, because we can't trust you to be alone in bed because you burned it.
This poor father. Like, he really needed that cake and that good news about his daughter's success, because he's like, oh my God, like, my son is vomiting blood and won't stop punching me in the face so he can go get drunk. I hate my life.
Truly, the, like, it's fine, he just hit me, it's fine, was, like, so much of how Branwell treated their dad was so rough.
Yikes. Ugh. Yeah. Oofta, oofta. My last little thing that I have here, because at the very end of the story, they are going for a walk with Charlotte's friend who comes to visit, and they see this phenomenon that makes it look as if there are three suns in the sky, and her friend is like, oh, that's the three of you guys, because you're so amazing. Mm-hmm. Lillian, do you know what that phenomenon is called?
No, and I didn't look it up.
It is called a sun dog. Moon dogs can also happen, but it's much less common. A sun dog is a phenomenon that happens when it's the refraction of light from the sun through highly crystallized atmospheres. So if it's really cold and there's a lot of, like, ice crystals in the air, it'll create this phenomenon that gives it almost like a global effect, and it projects, like, three reflections or two reflections of the sun on either side of it.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Hot safety tip. Don't stare at the sun like those ladies did.
No, they stared right at it
for so long.
Yeah, this is a sun dog.
The Brontes and Donald Trump do not care about their long-term eye health.
oh my gosh.
But I there's so many other things I would talk about with this. My biggest takeaway is you should watch it. You guys should watch this. It's good stuff. I'm going to watch it again for sure. Probably not immediately, but soon.
Lillian's already pressing play on the VCR because she taped it later.
I changed it how I watched this. So what I did was I bought a digital copy of it, and then I burned that onto a DVD, and then I burned my DVD onto a VHS, and then I blew the dust off my VHS player, popped that baby in, and I got it in the corner right now, and I'm going to watch it.
And it also came with a commercial of the Raisinettes that you couldn't, you tried to skip over it, but it just comes in there just for a blip right before the thing that's, returns from the ad.
All VHSs start with that now. Like, that's, I think, a legal requirement. And you might be picturing, like, Lillian has, like, a little old VHS player. No, I got one of those big, like, TV ones that has the VHS player built in.
Nice.
It's quite hefty. It does take up a good deal of space in my home.
Lillian, are you cool enough that you have the kind where, like, it, like, pops up from the top so you can, like, stick it in and then push it down? Or is it just the normal feed it in like it's a mouth and you're giving it a snack?
It's a feed it like a snack.
Okay, because that is pretty cute.
Yeah.
Got to put some googly eyes.
I say that as if I wouldn't go full hipster and do that so I could watch my Disney VHSs that are still in my mom's storage unit.
Yep. Same. Got mine too.
And I don't, like, no one I know has a way to play those, but we will get rid of those over my cold dead body.
There you go. They're saturated with childhood memories.
Okay. A couple little moments that I love is there, and that are sort of scattered throughout. I'm just glancing through my notes. One, towards the very beginning of the book or the story, when Emily and Anne are out for a walk, and Emily goes, "Are we playing?" And Anne goes, "Do you think we're maybe too old for that?" And she's like, "Ugh, then why'd you even come out here with me?" She's like, "I don't know. I thought we'd talk."
Like, about what? And she's like, "I don't know, things." Like, what do adults talk about?
And then they're on this walk together, and it's very sweet. And then they say probably my favorite line from the whole show, which is, Emily, they're kind of talking to each other. They're having this really honest conversation about life and what it should be. And was Charlotte, they're gossiping about their sister, because of course they are. And then they're sort of like having this banter back and forth. And all of a sudden Emily goes, "Shut up, people, hide."
Yes, I thought of you instantly when that happened. I was like, oh, Lillian's loving that part.
It's very good.
Oh, also quick pilot shout out to their cute puppies. Yeah. We've got a cute little fluffy spaniel and a big old, I don't know what he is, but he's a big old boy and he's sweet too.
Yeah, and Emily keeps feeding them at the table and the dad is like, "Emily, are you feeding those dogs?" And she's like, "No." Meanwhile, her hand under the table feeding the dogs.
He's too blind to see. It's fine.
How would he see? Oh. But all in all, really, really good. Are you ready to rate, or do we have other thoughts?
I am ready to rate. I also agree. It was very good and I liked it. So you guys who recommended it, not wrong. Correct.
Yeah.
Good job. Good you job. Did it.
This was in our wheelhouse. Congratulations.
Lillian, you're so passionate about it. You do the first rating.
I am going to give this 9 out of 10. Oh God. 9 out of 10. Tiny glasses.
Ooh, little spectacles.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. I am also going to give it a 9 out of 10, but I'm going to do 9 out of 10 bells for their fake names that they chose.
Nice. Do you want me to use a picture of a bell, or do you want me to use the word bell as a name?
Surprise me. Yeah.
And then something that I forgot to mention, the fashion in this, très magnifique. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very good.
It was
so good.
Also awesome that it was clearly well done and intentional that each girl had like a very distinctive kind of style to mm-hmm. themselves. I feel like you really see Anne and Charlotte having a bit more kind of like, I would classify it as a bit more like popular kind of fashions. Mm-hmm. And then Emily has kind of more just like random patterns. And she's like, "Well, I liked this tie-dye shirt and I'm going to wear it. And you guys can shut up because it's cool."
I also love that they had a very subtle Jane Eyre Got Money glow up after their books are published, where they all have like slightly nicer dresses.
Yep.
And I loved Anne's bonnet that she wears kind of throughout the film. That's very similar to the Jane Eyre 2011, very like woven sort of lacy bonnet.
I was thinking the same. And Lillian, here's my little headcanon, because I don't, the dates probably don't line up. But do we want to pretend that when Charlotte is talking to her siblings, I think it is, about like how the books are like getting like adapted and everything, and she's like, there's even going to be a play adaptation, and I'm like, let's pretend it's the one that we read.
We can pretend, we'll for sure pretend there's a 0% chance that it is.
That's okay.
But
there's also a 0% chance that that's the same Mrs. Robinson. Gotcha.
No! Let me have mine. I'm sure. Let me show you my board again. See the yarn? It goes from that person to one string. That person. It's a single string, and then it says, coincidence? I think not.
Well, it does hold up in court, so I guess you win. Ha! Nice.
Classic defense.
The eyes.
Classic defense, I think not. Lillian wins. Piper owes her $2.
I thought you were going to say two smooches. I'm going to blow them to you right now. There you go.
Aw, thanks. Listeners, on the way, I know that you can like hear that, but let them get all the way to me.
It's intercepting the kisses. How dare you, you kiss pirates.
I picture us on either side of our listeners. Is that not how you picture us?
Well, even though our podcast will be very respectively soon coming to a close, we will squeeze a tour, a national tour in there. And when we do, we'll make sure to set up on opposite ends of the stage.
We're not going to do a stage tour. We're going to show up. Our tour is going to be us coming to your house with microphones, and we'll record an episode with you in the room.
Oh my God.
You can't be part of it.
We're going to get so arrested. That'll be the true demise. But
so
yeah,
next week,
yes, tell us what's happening next week.
Next week, we are going to be doing another rewatch. This is going to be our last rewatch. As Piper alluded to, we are at least the Jane Eyre part of our podcast is coming to an end. But we've got a lot of episodes left, slightly less than 10. I can't remember how many.
9.
But...
One less than 10?
I can't remember if this is the, if
second.
We have 9 left or if we, I don't remember.
Whatever. but 3.
More than 3, less than 10.
Wow. There's a little puzzle for you.
So we are going to be doing a rewatch of the 1943. I fully said 1843 when I was telling our surprise guest to watch this, and he corrected me.
Nice.
But we've decided 1943 Jane Eyre, obviously, with Orson Welles and Joan
Fontaine.
There we go. And we will be having a very special guest. Our special guest will be my little brother. His name is Patrick, and he has other identities beyond being my little brother, but the important one is he's related to me.
Yeah.
This is nepotism, for those of you wondering. Feel free to write in the comments on our YouTube video when Patrick is on that he's a nepotism baby and you don't respect him.
Mm. Well, the thing is we're like, we need to like get somebody's like fresh takes, and he hasn't seen a version of this, right? I mean, I'm sure you've told him some things.
Yeah, his experience of Jane Eyre is mostly me forcing him to watch clips of this podcast that I made for YouTube.
Does he know the spoily already? You probably spoiled
the twist.
I think
he knows the big twist, but I don't know that he knows most of the plot. And I think he's also got some Orson Welles facts.
Nice.
I wouldn't describe him as a fan of Orson Welles as much as he is someone who knows things about Orson Welles.
There you go. Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be good stuff.
We'll get Patrick's takes on some things.
Yes. Hooray. I told him he's not allowed to tell me what he thinks before and that he shouldn't listen to our old episode of the podcast. So his takes are all hot and fresh.
Hell yeah, baby. Right out of the oven. So then, yeah, join us for that. And if you have thoughts about this version or fun facts that you want to share with us, you can do so on social at Airbuds or via email, airbuds@gmail.com. And even though things are changing soon, we still want nice reviews. So give us 5 stars or else.
Give us 5 stars.
Or we'll punch you and go buy a pint of lager.
We're not going to we won't punch you. We got in trouble one time. I think about it every time I hear somebody use the phrase punchable face. I think about how honest our listeners thought we were being about that.
No,
it is a phrase. It's not just something our friends say.
Yeah.
We promise no violence for real. We don't support real violence. We support pretend violence when you punch your dad for money in a show.
Yeah.
And when we make jokes about it on podcasts.
Yeah. So punch 3-5 stars into your phone and send it to us on your favorite podcasting app of choice.
Did we already say we're at AirPods on social? I genuinely can't remember.
I did say that, Lily.
Okay, cool.
But it's Groundhog's Day. So we love you guys. We'll see you next time. Happy Jane Eyre reading and watching.
Bye. Goodbye.